excellence in teaching and so on. But okay, so the title of the talk was From Symmetries to String Theory. So so this talk is going to have several components. The first half, we're going to walk through symmetries, as I explained in the abstract. And then we will go all the way to perhaps in a small historical path, all the way to the discovery of a string theory. And then we will, I'll try to tell you what a string theory does for us at the moment. Okay. But before I do that, I mean, usually I think that last year, and I don't know if this year we're doing the same thing, but usually keynote speakers usually tell you, we try to tell you something about ourselves or what it means to be a physicist, right? So I decided to tell you something that will also serve as an excuse, and which is the following. I think working, so when you're a physicist and you try to find out the secrets of the mystery of the universe and so on, one of the things that you have to do is to work very, very hard, okay? So since March, I've been working on a project, and the project just came out yesterday night. So I spent like 3 weeks having only maybe 3 or 4 hours of sleep. So please bear with me because I might mess up. I made everything up this morning that I'm going to tell you about today, or maybe 10 minutes ago. So just to be more precise about this morning. But hopefully we will try to have fun and try to ask a lot of questions and so on. So Richard also already said that I got my PhD from Harvard, but before that, I got my BSc. In Venezuela, okay? So, you know, this oil producer country, that's probably what you have heard of Venezuela. But so I got my BSc there. So as I was finishing, as I was a senior there, in my last year, I realized that I wanted to do a PhD, but I had a small technical problem. The small technical problem was that I didn't speak English. So I had to find a plan B, right? Because I couldn't go to a nice place like Princeton or something like that because I didn't speak English. So, well, my plan B was to go to a place where they didn't require English. So I went to the ICTP. This is the Institute, the International Center for Theoretical Physics in Italy, where I went to learn high energy physics and English. Okay? So I don't know if you can sense my Italian accent, but in any case. So after that, okay, so I learned English and high energy physics, so I went to Harvard. And from there, I went to the Institute for Advanced Study, where perhaps something interesting, I mean, perhaps the most interesting thing that happened was that there I met Ed Witten. And the reason I want to mention this is that no matter how smart you think you are, you will never know what it means to be smart until you meet Ed Witten. When you do, then you start to understand that you are not as smart as you thought, right? And perhaps that you are not even smart enough to understand how smart he really is. So, yes, it's good to start with that. So, it was then when I realized that I wasn't really smart. But I realized also that there is something where, I mean, maybe we're not as smart as he is, but there is something that can make a difference that can help you succeed in physics, which is your passion for physics, right? If you have enough passion, maybe that can compensate for not being as smart as he is, right? And that's the only thing that we have, the rest of humankind, to compete with him. That's the passion that we have for physics, okay? And my passion, somehow, was how come that mathematics, that is something abstract, knows about nature, right? And how come that nature chooses some of the mathematical objects that we have developed, sometimes even independently, okay? So I know that Sundance gave you an introduction to the standard model. Yes or no?
Yes.
I mean, I just read the abstract. It was the slide here. Okay, so I would like to start a little bit with the standard model because it's going to lead us to something interesting that will also happen in string theory and which you probably have heard before, and that's a point that I want you to take with you. So that's the path we're going to follow today, standard model. Okay, but the way we're going to do it, I think, is going to be different from the way Sundance did it. Especially because, as I told you, I just came out with this 10 minutes ago, so it certainly will be different. His is probably better. Let's start with rotations in two dimensions, right? So what do I mean by this? Well, we start with a plane, okay? And we want to describe something that happens in an experiment somewhere here, right? So we give these point coordinates, x0 and y0. Very good. Now suppose that we rotate the experiment, okay, by an angle theta. Okay. Now our new description of the phenomenon has coordinates x0 prime and y0 prime, right? So how do we relate the two descriptions of the same phenomenon? Well, we have to make a change of coordinates, right? So our object that was here now is here. So how are the coordinates related? Does anybody know? Let's see. x0 prime, okay? So probably you guys can do it in your head. Okay. Maybe with a minus here. Right? Is that correct? What I told you. You have to check everything that I'm doing because I did it 10 minutes ago. So there is a nice way. I don't like this. I mean, two equations. This looks a little bit clumsy and so on. So there is a nice way of making this a little bit more appealing to the eye, which is to make it a matrix equation. Okay? You think about this as a vector, two-component vector. That is related to another two-component vector under the action of an operator. Yes. What I told you, there is a minus sign either here or here. Okay, let's check. So if theta is equal to 0, okay, everything works. Now, suppose that x0, suppose that y0 was 0, right? It's here. And you make a 90-degree rotation. Under that thing, try to check if this equation is correct. There is a minus sign either here or here, okay? So up to the minus sign, which you are supposed to check, okay, which is either here or here, this would be the equation. Are you happy with this kind of equations? So what this means is that you multiply this with this, and it means that you take this times this plus this times this, you get this equation, which is equal to this part here. Then you multiply this with this, and then you get this equation here, okay? Excellent. Now, what is a nice property of this thing? So you see, if you measure the distance from here to here, okay, what is the distance? Well, the distance we know, or the distance squared from here to here is x0 squared plus y0 squared. Now, if you guys rotate this, okay, what do you think is going to happen to the new distance from the origin to this point? It's supposed to stay the same. Okay? So surprise, this thing, as complicated as it looks, if you plug it in here, it's supposed to give you the same answer. Okay? So these transformations that act on these vectors and give you a new vector that satisfies the same properties as the original one in terms of the distance are called SO2. Okay, what does it mean, SO2? Well, O stands for orthogonal, which means that it preserves the angles. It's a transformation that preserves the angles, special. The S stands for special. It means that it preserves the length of the object. Okay, it preserves the areas, not only the angles. And the two means that we are in two dimensions. It's only a two-dimensional object. That is an object that acts on a two-dimensional space. Okay, very good. Now, there is also something interesting about this. Let me call this object here M that depends on the angle, right? Now, what happens if I act on my vector x0, y0 with this thing, and then the vector that I get, I act on it by applying another transformation, that is another rotation by an angle m theta 2. What do you think happens if I first rotate by theta 1 and then by theta 2? What's the total answer? I mean, what's the total effect? Excellent, yes, that's true. So I encourage you to try to multiply these two matrices by putting theta 1 and theta 2 and checking that the answer is the same matrix with theta replaced by theta 1 plus theta 2. That's very amusing. It's not obvious at all, right? All right, very good. Now let's talk about something that seems to be completely independent of that, which are complex numbers. Okay? Everybody familiar with complex numbers? Very good. So I'm going to use the standard notation for complex numbers. So x and y are real numbers. Okay, so we all know what real numbers are. I is just whatever we have to add to the complex, to the real numbers, in order to solve this equation. Okay? This equation doesn't have solutions in the real numbers. Therefore, we have to add something to the real numbers to have a solution to this. It's just like when you have the rational numbers, okay, and you have the equation x squared equal to 2. This equation doesn't have solutions in the rational numbers, and you have to add something to the rational numbers. You have to extend the rational numbers, and you do it by what? By adding to the rational numbers a new number, which is called the square root of 2. Okay? Here you're doing exactly the same thing. Okay? You're just considering R with an extra object. Very good. So how is that related to this story here? Well, the relation is very simple. Know the following. This object is supposed to satisfy this equation. But let me ask you the following question. Take this matrix, okay, and multiply this matrix by itself. What do you get? Very quickly. Okay. Anyone? Done? Okay, minus one here. Excellent. Here. I get minus the identity. So you see that there is something interesting here. If I relate, if I make the following map, I relate the number 1 to the identity, and I relate I to this mysterious matrix, I get something that behaves exactly like a complex number, right? And therefore, I can represent a complex number as something that looks like this. Okay? And everything that you do with complex numbers, you can do it with these matrices. You can check that multiplication, everything goes, it behaves precisely like that. Okay, now there is a special class of complex numbers which Euler, one of the greatest mathematicians of all times, was in love with them. And, well, you know, I mean, maybe because We know it's Euler first, and probably he invented the thing, so he was in love with the thing. It's these kind of weird things. So he thought that this was the most beautiful equation ever in the history of mathematics. The reason was that all this equation had everything that you can ever imagine, right? It had transcendental numbers, it had imaginary numbers, the basics of our number system, everything. Well, but in any case, this is an example of one of these very special complex numbers that I want to talk about. Let me call them U. And these are numbers made out of this, where theta is a real number. And not only is a real number, I'll just let it go from 0 to 2 pi. Okay? It's an angle. Okay? Have you seen these numbers? Okay, excellent. Very good. Now you know that there is something interesting, right? So if you take two complex numbers, say z prime, okay, and then you take z, and you say that z prime is equal to e to the I theta z, do you think that this equation has any relation to something that we have written somewhere else? Well, this equation is exactly this equation. Okay? Well, but then there is something surprising, right? Because this equation is telling us that the matrix we wrote there, this matrix there, can also be written as a very amusing object. It can be written as e to the 0, minus 1, 1, 0, theta. It's the exponential of a matrix. This object here is called a generator of these transformations. Okay? So we have just discovered what the generator of SO2 transformations is. Okay? The group of these transformations also has a name, even though it looks very much like that one. It's called U1. Okay? And we just discovered that U1 is the same as SO2. Can anybody guess what U means? Unitary. What it means is that if you take any of these special complex numbers and you compute its magnitude, what do you get? 1. Very good. Now, you might be wondering now, well, what is this? I mean, what is physics? We're about to get there, so don't panic. Almost there. We just have to make a few more generalizations to SO32, and then we're going to be there. Here. Let's go one more step. Let's go to three dimensions. Okay? So in three dimensions, again, we have x, y, z. So we can make the same idea. We have our event here, x naught, y naught, z naught. And we rotate it somewhere. Okay. And once again, I would like to write this as a vector. Okay. So how can I describe a general rotation in three dimensions? Isn't that a little bit complicated? I mean, imagine I can do many, many crazy things, right, in three dimensions. Sorry? Yes, I use a 3x3 matrix. Very good. But then to describe, how many parameters do you think a three-dimensional rotation has? How many? Okay. Are you sure? Well, let me tell you the answer by doing it. So one way to define a three-dimensional rotation would be to actually do a rotation first in the xy plane, right? Or in the yz plane. So let's do it in the yz plane. And do nothing in the x direction by an angle gamma, say. Okay? And then perform another rotation in the which one do I want to choose now? Okay, well, it doesn't matter the order. Maybe I should follow my notes. Well, this one was second, but okay. And I messed it up there. Okay, doesn't matter. So let's do one in this plane with an angle alpha. And finally, we do one in this plane. So we now need a one here. So we do cosine beta 0 sine beta sine beta. Okay. So we need three angles because we have three planes on which to make a rotation, right? So there are three. Okay. To parameterize the rotation, we need three angles. Pretty good. Now, what is the object that this transformation as a whole leaves invariant? You see, here, this was the object that this transformation left invariant. What is the object that this transformation leaves invariant here? Epsilon with z, yes, that's right. Excellent. Okay. Did I mess up some? Yes.
Yeah, the first thing
this one.
Bottom.
Oh, here there is, yes, of course. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. And you already checked that everything is correct. There is a minus sign there. Yes. With a sign, yes. Okay, very good, very good. We're getting, it's going to be very important. Yes. Excellent. Now the question, the natural question is there something like U1 in this case, right? Here we found that there was something natural in complex numbers that was related to these rotations, to SO2. Oh, which, by the way, here, these are called, as you might guess, SO3. Okay. Well, the answer is yes. There is something like this in this case, okay? And something that would look like precisely like that. And let me tell you what it is. You take, so here we're going to have problems with notation, okay? This is what happens when you do something 10 minutes before coming to the lecture, which is that complex numbers are usually called z, and if you have two complex numbers, you call them z and w. But then in the coordinates, the third coordinate is usually called z, okay? So I hope that you won't get confused between this z and this z, okay? So this z is a complex number. And this W is also a complex number. So we are now living in C2. You know what this means? So if you have R2, it's a plane. If you have C2, it's just two copies of a complex plane, right? Now we have something acting. It's a 2x2 matrix, but made out of complex numbers. The entries are complex numbers, acting on this thing. And it's a transformation that acts on this thing and gives you a pair of complex numbers. Now, this thing here is again of the same form as we did it there, but now we need three angles. Therefore, we need three matrices, right? There we only have one matrix, where these sigmas are these matrices. And they are so famous that they even have a name. Does anybody know the name of these matrices? Maybe you know. Yes? How do you call them? I don't mean the Greek letter. I mean this set of matrices is so famous that, I mean, it has the name of a physicist. So the poly matrices. Okay, excellent. And we just have written down a very nice group that is called SU2. Well, the U stands for unitary. Okay. Once again, if you take this matrix and you multiply it by the transpose conjugate, you get the identity matrix, just like what we did there. S stands for special. Special means that the determinant is equal to 1. And 2 stands for the fact that it acts on a two-dimensional complex space. So we have SU2. All right. So we are very happy with this. So, well, it worked for SO2. It worked for SO3. So we follow the path of any physicist and say, oh, it surely works for any SON. So you would think that it works for SO4, right? Where we would have transformations in 4 dimensions, right? And you would say that this thing lives invariant something like this. Once again, I couldn't come up with a better notation. Hey, do you have any suggestions? Oh, I know. Okay, don't panic. You see, that's once you get ambitious and you want to go to all n, then you better start doing this. Okay, then you start looking like a mathematician. Okay. Then you have this. And then you ask, is there anything similar to this that I can do? And then the answer is, not really. The closest you can get to something like this, something as nice as this, is actually 2 copies of the old one, which is kind of weird. OK? So it doesn't work for all n. I mean, it's not as beautiful. Then you stop. OK. Then we now start with physics. This is just to show you that sometimes just doing beautiful things and trying to generalize them does not always work. Have you heard about unification? Can you give me examples of unification in physics? Well, just raise your hands because, yes? Excellent, yes, very good. So that's very nice unification. 2 very strange and different phenomena, electric and magnetic, into one of it. More unifications, yes?
Electromagnetic with weak equations.
Oh, wow, that's fancy. Yes, OK. This, but then you have the weak force, and then you put them together, and then you get the electrical weak. I always wonder what happened to the magnetic. OK, any other? Yes?
Maybe like movements of the heavens and the air?
Beautiful. That's a very nice example, yes. That's right. The fact that the interaction between the air and an apple is the same, or is described by the same force as interaction of the Earth and the Moon, and the same as interaction of the Sun plus the Earth, is outstanding. I mean, why would that be the case? I mean, that's a big unification, right? OK, any other? No, we are not there yet. Yes, that's right. The description of 2 different phenomena, wave and particles, and now. But we are all messed up with that one yet. I mean, you can ask many of my friends here in the building who are still trying to understand that. Yes. I follow a more pragmatic approach. So, okay, yes, so what? So let's continue. No. More seriously, yes, that's right. The particle wave. Okay, let me mention just one more, just for fun. the periodic table, right? That was such a terrible mess. I mean, we're so lucky that we don't have to learn all these elements and so on, and each of the properties. And, well, people who do chemistry, they have to. But, I mean, we don't really have to devise new rules all the time and so on. We just unified all this into just three objects. What are the three objects? We can describe all the periodic table in terms of only three particles, right? Yes. Yes, the neutrons, protons, and electrons. So that's very nice. How about a more fancy unification? Like, we know we have a space, and there is time. Okay, space-time. Well, but how can you go ahead and unify that? Well, you see that we had a very early, oh, that's what happens with this thing. So let's try. We had a very early attempt here to unify space and time. We were doing very well here with SO3, rotations in three dimensions. Then we tried SO4, and we failed miserably. Okay. Well, but you see now, you can tell the problem, right? The problem is that if you think about this as a space, right, and this thing as time, this equation doesn't really tell the difference. And we surely know that we cannot go back and fix something that we didn't do carefully yesterday, right? So surely this equation cannot be the right way to unify space and time, right? Well, what if we try to make it something different here, right? Try to make time different. Besides, time, we cannot just put time here, right? Well, is there any problem with this equation if we just interpret this as a space and this as time? They don't have the same units, so we would be doing something extremely silly, indeed. Very good. Okay, so there are two. One conceptual issue, which is that if we put time here, we will screw it up because we cannot go back to the time. We cannot make a rotation to go back in time as easily as we can just rotate and go in that direction. And the second one is that they don't even have the same units. Okay, so let's try something else. Let's try to make X4 special. We now are very familiar with complex numbers here, right? So what if we make X4 a purely imaginary number? So let's make X4 a purely imaginary number. But we also have to fix the dimensions, right? So let's put a C there. Okay. So what happens if we plug that into this equation? Okay. Well, what we get is, let me go back to our old notation. What happens to this I when I square it? I get -1. Okay. Now I put primes everywhere, and I'm looking for transformations that will do the following. Okay. And since this guy was there only to fix the units, it better stay the same. Well, you see, transformations that do this are called SO3,1. Can anybody guess why the 3 and why the 1? Yes, because there are 3 that have plus sign and 1 that has minus sign. Don't tell space and time to a mathematician because he will not understand. But if you tell him, look, I'm looking at SO3,1, he will immediately know what you're talking about. Okay? He doesn't even care. For all he knows, there might be 3 times and 1 space. So it doesn't really matter. Okay, very good. So we have SO3,1. Now we can ask the question again. Is there something similar to what we did before here? Okay, and the answer is yes, quite surprisingly. This thing is actually equivalent to something that is very, very nice and simple. It's called SL2C. And I'll tell you what it is. It's exactly this here, okay? E to the alpha, sigma 1, plus beta, sigma 2, plus gamma, sigma 3. You would say, well, how can it be the same as that? Because it would be called SU2 and not SL2C. Well, the difference is that here, alpha, beta, and gamma were angles, right? Here, guess what? These guys are complex numbers. So let me ask you something. Let's see if you can recognize a pattern. In two dimensions, how many angles we needed to describe everything? One. In three dimensions, three. In four dimensions, how many do you need? Well, I told you already the trick, right? It's the number of planes where you have to do the rotation, right? How many planes are there in four dimensions? Well, you can start saying numbers, and once you get to the right way, I'll say yes. Six. Well, you got it in one shot. Yes. Excellent. Yes, six. So try to work out how many angles you need in n dimensions. OK, now where are our six angles in this equation? Well, I told you that each of these guys are complex numbers, right? So alpha is really alpha 1 plus I alpha 2. Beta is really beta 1 plus I beta 2. And gamma is 1 plus I gamma 2, right? Now, note the following. These guys are the ones we already knew, right? The real ones, alpha 1, beta 1, and gamma 1. So if you let these guys be the only thing that you have here, the transformation you get is just a rotation in three dimensions. How about the mysterious ones? And space, you're doing a rotation that changes space and time. That's actually called a boost. There are three boosts and three rotations, right? So if you work out everything here, you will discover the Lorentz transformations. So Lorentz transformations are nothing but a rotation in space-time where time is described in this way. It's a complex rotation, okay? Now, here is the most important thing of all this exercise. Objects in a space-time, particles, are going to be classified, or, well, it's too pretentious to say that they are classified. We classify them. I mean, maybe nature chooses a different way of doing it, but the best way we have to classify particles nowadays is by the way this group acts on them, right? Now, we have seen that the Lorentz group, now we can give a name to this thing, it's called the Lorentz group. The Lorentz group can act on vectors made out of complex numbers. These guys, right? So we have two complex numbers, Z and W, and this guy acts on them. Particles that are affected by a transformation in that form are called spinors. And particles that transform like the coordinates, okay, which are basically four vectors, guess how they are called? Four vectors. Yes, that's right. So all particles we know, except for one, which I'm not going to tell you what it is, are either four vectors or the spinors. Okay. Very good. I hope I won't have to use it again. That's a very important blackboard, so we should keep it there for the remaining of the lecture. Okay, so probably Sundance told you that there are in the standard model, there are force carriers, and there is matter, right, which are the ones that interact, right? Okay. So actually, there is something very interesting here, which is that force carriers are actually four vectors, and matter are spinners. How nice. Why is it like this? Well, nobody knows. Okay. There is an exception here, but we don't know if it's there. It's the Higgs. Okay. The Higgs is actually something that when you perform a rotation, nothing happens to it. Okay? So there is the most boring object in terms of the Lorentz group. And it's called a scalar. Okay? So some people say that, well, maybe the Higgs is actually made out of something else, which follows the same pattern that we have seen. Yeah. All right, very good. So where are these guys here? Well, you probably have heard of photons, gluons, and what else? And these two mysterious guys, right? Very good. Now, with everything that we have done here, I can actually tell you, and that will end the part of the standard model, with a description of what we know nowadays and how every particle that we know is classified according to the way they transform under some symmetries, the way we have described them here. Okay, so now that we discovered several groups today. We discovered the group U1. We also discovered the group SU2. Right? We discovered the Lorentz group. Okay. Let me put it here. And, well, if there is a 1, if there is a 2, probably there is a 3. There is something that is called SU3. Okay. And I can challenge you to discover, well, okay, maybe. How many parameters are there to describe SU3 the way we did it here for SU2? Actually, the answer is going to be in the table that I'm going to write. Okay. So let's start with something here. Let's start first with what? Let's start with the gluons. Okay. So I told you the gluons, under the Lorentz group, they transform as four vectors. Okay. Under SU3, they transform as an eight-dimensional object. Under SU2, they don't transform. And under U1, they don't transform. About quarks. Actually, there are two different kinds of quarks. Apart from all the flavor, in all the flavors they come, right? But each flavor has two different animals, really. I mean, when we talk about the electron, we always are happy to say, oh, we have an electron and so on. But really, the electron is made out of two different objects. One is called the right-handed electron, and the other one is the left-handed electron. The problem is that at the energies where we usually live, we don't see the difference between, we cannot split the two pieces. The two pieces combine into one object, which is what we call the electron. But all these spinners split up into two objects, which are called left and right. I'll tell you why. And then we can also talk about the electrons. Okay. So let's just complete this table very quickly here, and we're going to be done. Right, so we have. So this guy, under the Lorentz group, all these guys are twos. Under SU3, these guys are threes. And these guys do nothing. Under SU2, that's the table. And under U1, all of these guys have some electric charge. OK? Now, anything that transforms under SU3 any matter that transforms under that, we call it quarks. And any matter that doesn't transform under the SU3, we call it leptons. Well, you would say, well, you only wrote electrons there. But there are also muons and tauons, right? So muons and tauons are also examples of electrons, of leptons, OK? So everything that we know in nature is made out of quarks and leptons. We have the gluons. And I don't have space in the table, but there are the force carriers of SU2 and U1. And they are called usually A1, 2, 3. And what is the other one? B. So this one is the one of U1. And this one is the one of SU2. Okay, they are force here both. Okay, and these two guys combine to produce a photon and what we call now W plus and Z naught. Okay. So I'll end the first part of the lecture by telling you one of the most important lessons of this thing, and it's the following. You know, if you were a mathematician, yes. Oh, that if you perform an SU2 rotation, this object doesn't do anything. It stays the same. Stays put.
What about A and the B? Say you have to do 16 times rotations.
No. No, it's just it's that the gluons, that SU3 can act on an A-dimensional object. Just like SU2 acts on a two-dimensional object, and SO3, which is the same as SU2 roughly, acts on a three-dimensional object, right? Very good. Okay, so what is the lesson from here? Yes. Yes, actually, yes. Every component of a gluon, so it's funny. You have a gluon, it's actually a complicated object, right? You can think about a gluon as a four vector under the Lorentz group, but each component is an eight vector under SU3. Or you can also think that there are eight gluons, and each gluon is a four vector under the SOA, under SO3,1. So these things are big objects with many indices. Okay, but that precisely brings us into what I wanted to say. And that's why I went through all this. And it's the following. Why is there just this pattern here? Why don't we have SU15, SU30, many more guys interacting in many other representations, many different numbers here and so on. So math has given us a nice framework to describe particle physics. But that framework is very, very general. It's very, very large. It has many, many possibilities. Okay? And nature seems to have chosen just a particular one. Okay? So some people might describe that as a landscape of possibilities. OK, so we have this landscape of possibilities. Well, if you are pessimistic, you would say, oh, that's bad. Well, but if you are optimistic, you would say, oh, that's remarkable. It's actually remarkable that nature had chosen something as simple as this. Well, you're not completely sure that it's as simple as this. But come on, think about this. This is just very deep, very short distances. The building blocks of nature are described by something that it took me only 1 hour to tell you about, SU2, U1, SO3,1. I mean, how remarkable that is. I mean, it's extremely simple compared to what it could have been, right? So my point is that it's actually remarkable. That there is such a framework. Okay? And this landscape of possibility is the nature of this framework. Now, probably you realize already that I'm missing something, right, from this whole picture. So we talk about the electroweak force, about the strong force, everything, but we're missing something, right? What is it that we're missing? Gravity, yes. How about gravity? All right, very good. So here we go. We start our trip with Euclidean geometry around 320 BC. Okay? So that's how far ago we can go with geometry, right? So our friends here, they had some axioms, right? One of them was that, well, right angles are the same everywhere, right? And the other one is that two parallel lines will never meet. Out of those two axioms, you get the whole Euclidean geometry. Well, actually, we can say it in a very nice way now. We can say that what they were actually talking about was that the symmetries of space was SO3 and translations. Okay? So we can translate that to say that we have SO3. Very good. Then Newton came along. Okay. And he said something very nice. He said, well, if you have a particle that is not acted upon by any force, then it will move in a straight line or it will stay where it is, right? Well, can we make that statement into a geometrical statement? Well, that law of inertia can be restated by saying that particles move anywhere. In a straight line in a space-time. Right? Think about it. If a particle is moving with a constant velocity, think about the particle is moving in space-time. And it's actually moving in a straight line. If a particle is not moving at all, is also moving in a straight line in space-time, right? Now we have a nice way of saying that, of course, thanks to Einstein. And the way to say it is that we have an SO3,1 symmetry. I mean, I wonder why don't they tell you that when you learn about Newton's laws, right? That would be the nicest way to say it. Okay, very good. So we continue our trip. And now, just to tell you how mathematicians can come and actually beat physicists, Riemann came and completely changed the paradigm. He said, we are missing a lot of things with Euclidean geometry. There is actually curved geometry. Okay. Well, probably the inspiration was again the same apple. But now you add a crucial element to the apple, which is an ant walking there in the apple. Okay? And you imagine that you are the ant walking in the apple, around the apple, and then you say, oh shoot, this apple is not flat, right? So there must be some curvature. And then you came out with a reformulation of Euclidean geometry after 2,000 years, just because you realized. Well, if you want to describe the curvature of a one-dimensional space, right, say embedded in two dimensions, right, at each point, all you have to tell me is the radius of curvature of the circle that is tangent to this thing. So all you need is one number. In two dimensions, you actually need three numbers. So this is one more of these pattern exercises. Can anyone tell me how many numbers you need here? Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, good. How about 5? Oh, okay. Excellent. What did you say?
Oh, no, it's 16.
Come on. It's actually 15. I told you, I haven't slept for 3 hours. Okay, very good. Now, very good. Okay, so we have, so Riemann came out with all this nice structure and everything. So the real breakthrough is to think that forces, right, if particles that are not acting upon force, that there is no force acting on the particles, are actually moving in a straight line in space-time. Maybe if something, what we think is a particle that is moving and there is a force acting on the particle, and therefore the guy is not moving in a straight line, maybe the idea is not that there is something fancy called the force and so on, but that maybe the space is curved. And then this guy is just trying to move in a straight line, but the space, just like the ant, but the space is curved. And then we will think that there is a force. Okay? So maybe forces are just a reflection of the curvature of a space-time. Maybe. Okay, well, we know that Einstein came along and told us that precisely gravity is such a thing, okay? And that when you have matter in a space-time, you curve the space-time, and anything else that tries to move around will also feel the effect of the curvature, and that's why it's not going to move in a perfectly straight line from the point of view of a flat space-time like SO3,1. But it's going to try its best to move in a straight line. But if the space, if the underlying space is curved, it won't be able to do it. Okay? It will just follow whatever it can. Now, you try again as a physicist and you say, oh, wow, this is the most beautiful thing ever. Right? So it's surely clear that all the other forces are also describable in terms of the same thing, of course. How such a beautiful thing cannot be true. Then you are Kaluza, and you try the thing in 1990. Very soon after Einstein came out with this, and you say, well, there is electromagnetism. So maybe what is happening is that we actually live in 5 dimensions, right? Weird, right? Well, I have to tell you something. Einstein came out with gravity here, right? And gravity, in order to describe gravity, you need something that has 10 numbers, right? That's called the metric. But that's not important for us at the moment. What is important is that Kaluza said, well, 15 is the same as 10 plus 5. Brilliant, right? But not only that. This 10 also has a nice property. It can be written as a 4x4 matrix, right? Okay. Where you impose that the lower half of the matrix is the same as the upper half. Okay? So how many independent components do you have in this matrix? You have 10. Right? If you impose that the lower half is the same as the upper half, you have 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1, which is also known as 10. Right? Well, Kaluza came out with the idea that maybe the world is described by a 5x5 matrix, where you have 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, which is 15. And that gravity is described by the upper 4x4 part of this matrix. This 4 vector is the 4 vector that describes electromagnetism, that is a photon. And then there is this, well, this extra piece. We became very close, which would be a scalar, right? Well, it turns out that nobody has seen that scalar with the properties that Caluso described, and that's why the theory didn't fly. But it was a beautiful theory, right? It kind of unified everything into just one geometrical object. Also, quantum mechanics came along, and then quantum mechanics told us that, well, life is not just like geometry and so on, something beautiful and smooth, but actually reality seems to be something where very unexpected things have happened. Things can pop out of the vacuum and so on. So this notion of a very smooth and very beautiful geometry is somehow not quite correct. So the whole geometric picture was somehow not doing very well, okay? Okay. So people didn't continue with that. Well, perhaps except Einstein, who continued looking for a geometric unification. But that idea didn't fly very much. And people were still making progress with the quantum mechanics and everything. And I just need to make progress with finding chalk. I don't know where the chalk went. Maybe this will. I know there was a lot of chalk at the beginning of the lecture. Okay, doesn't matter. I think this one will do. Okay. So at the same time, people were continuing with, so this didn't fly. So quantum mechanics took over. Oh, thank you.
That?
Yeah. Yes. So quantum mechanics took over. Everything was going fine, and people were discovering wonderful things. Until they started to measure particles like the proton and the neutron. But then these particles were being created at high energies, and these particles had very weird properties. They had a spin, and they had a mass, which satisfied a relation that could not be explained like if these guys were just point-like particles. These guys started to behave like strings. Okay, so there were experiments. Strong interacting particles were actually behaving more and more like strings. So that in the 60s led people to introduce a string theory as a theory to explain these strong interactions. So everybody was very excited because this string theory was making beautiful predictions, everything was working fine, and so on. And then what happened? These guys at the Slack, okay, this high energy accelerator, they started to experiment with these strongly interacting particles. And then they realized that at very high energies, they started to behave again like point-like particles. It's as if they had point-like structures inside them. And that was what was the only way to explain the experiments. And this picture of strings could not do that. So this thing didn't work. So at the Slack said that at high energies, strong interactions were actually explained by point-like particles. Okay. Well, it's not completely true that the string theory was doing extremely well. There were two small problems, at least two. One is that the theory was quantum mechanically only consistent in 26 dimensions. So you see, if we had fun with SO3,1, imagine SO25,1. Okay. The best you could do was to add to the theory fermions, I mean, things like the electron. And if you add to the theory electrons or things like the electron, you can bring down this to 10. But still 10 is a little bit far from 4. Okay. But there was another problem with this thing at the time, which was that no matter what you did, these spinning strings behave like different particles, right? Because a string can vibrate in different modes. So one of the modes that was always there, and nobody could get rid of that, was a mode that required 10 numbers to describe. So everybody was upset because in these experiments, there was no way you could get some particle that needed 10 numbers to be described. Okay? And people tried very hard to get rid of this and to bring down the dimension. Nobody could. Well, later on, somebody realized that, well, what could this be? Or what could this thing be describing? Actually, it could be describing gravity. So this thing, what they discover is that the string theory predicts, and there is no way to get rid of it, because people try very hard and they couldn't. So this is a prediction of the string theory, that there is gravity. No, it's remarkable, because you didn't put it in, okay? And no matter how hard you tried, you couldn't get it out. So that's what you call a prediction. Especially if it's something that you were not looking for it, and it was there, and you thought it was a mistake, and you couldn't get rid of it. That's really a prediction. If somebody tells you, if somebody's looking for something and finds it, you should say, oh, yeah, right, let me check your calculation. But if somebody says, oh, shoot, I found this thing, I should throw this theory to the garbage and so on, you probably can trust what they found. And it was gravity, okay? But then there was still this problem, 10 dimensions. Very good. Now, the string theory became a theory of gravity and extra dimensions. But then we can go back to Kaluza and Klein, who later on computed some properties of these extra dimensions, and say, well, maybe, you see, we know that there are more than photons in life. There are more interactions. There is U1, SU2, plus SU3. Could it be that these extra dimensions will allow you to describe all these particles, all these interactions, just the way Kaluza was thinking about that? Well, people were excited, and they said, well, yes, let's go for it, and let's study this. And remarkably, they found that there were only 5 theories that were consistent. Okay. I'll tell you the names, but they don't mean much at this point. But you know what this is, SO32. I wasn't joking when I started saying that we had to go all the way to SO32. Now, there were only 5 consistent theories, so that's spectacular, right? I mean, you would say, well, okay, very nice. But still, well, I mean, if you are claiming that you're finding the theory, the ultimate theory of the world, having 5 theories is not very, nice. But in 1995, I mean, mainly due to Witten, once again, people started to discover dualities, okay? And these dualities were amazing relations between very different objects, just like this particle wave duality, that were relating particles or objects that were living here to objects that were living here and here and here and here. So very soon, in a few years, a whole picture of how all these theories are interconnected started to develop. Okay, people were making connections with this, this one with this. It became a sport. You should try your own duality, and then make it there, and everybody would be excited. And very soon, in a few years, a whole web of dualities was developed. And it was understood that all these things, actually this picture had a meaning, and this thing was describing something that is called M theory. Okay. Well, once again, everybody was very excited and said, oh, now we have the unified theory of everything. Right? Excellent. Now, how was this possible? right? If you had different strings here doing different things, how come that they are related to one another? Well, the key to that unification, this is again another example of unification, but much more fancy. The key to that unification was the realization by Polchinski. I don't remember how to spell it. Is there a Y or? Probably there is a Y somewhere. Okay, well, Polchinski, that string theory is not just a theory of strings, as you probably have heard. There are other objects in string theories. And these are called D-brains. Okay. And you really need lots of brains to to come out with this one. So what are D-brains? So remember that we have these strings, okay? So we started our study with the strings. They can be open or closed strings, okay? Now Polchinski realized that there are objects in string theory defined by the property that strings can end on them and stay there. The endpoint can only travel on that wall, so to speak. If this wall has p space directions and one time direction, right? This is called a p-brain. Can anybody tell me what a string would be in this language? What p? What would be the P that I have to use to describe a string? Yes, a one brain. Yes, excellent. So the key to this unification was actually that the strings here, okay, became, actually if I move here, it would be more precise. The strings from here became the one brains in this theory, and the one brains here became the strings here, and so on. So that was the missing piece. And that's how all this picture could emerge very nicely, okay? Not only that, but also D-brains can do something special. If you have several D-brains, strings can end on them like this. Of course, you can also have closed strings floating around and so on. And very, very nicely, you can see that when you put several D-brains together, the strings that stretch from one brain to another one precisely give you this all the particles you need to describe, if you have n of them, to describe an SUN symmetry. Just the SUN that we were talking about. So if you put three brains together, you can get an SU3. If you put two brains together, you can get an SU2. One single brain is U1. So everybody was like, oh, okay, so we're done now. We just put brains, everything that we need, and so on. We'll get the standard model. We will be done and go home. And then find another job. Luckily, we haven't succeeded. Okay. And the reason we haven't succeeded is what I'm going to tell you in the next 10 minutes. Okay. Have lots of time. Okay, so the reason we haven't succeeded is that we have to do something with these extra 10 dimensions, right? So the way to deal with that is by taking a six-dimensional object, right, times our space-time. And if this six-dimensional object is very tiny, like say our space-time is this, and over each point you put a tiny circle, say, you wouldn't be able to tell that that circle is there. It's like if you have a hose, right? If you're close to the hose, you can tell that the hose has two dimensions. If you go to the moon and you only see the hose going around the Earth, you will think that that hose has only one dimension, right? So the That was what Kaluza tried to do with Kaluza's idea. He said that, well, it had to be a circle. How small that circle had to be? It had to be of the order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Okay, that was his computation. That's why he got his name into the Kaluza claim thing. So we know that this object here is now not a circle. It's a more complicated thing. It's a six-dimensional object. And it has to be very, very tiny. But what six-dimensional object you put in there, we don't quite know. What we know is that a special class of these objects that does something nice is called Calabi Yau manifolds. Okay? Many years ago, people thought that these Calabi Yau manifolds were very unique and there were very few of them. And then we would just look at them, classify them, and we would be done. But it didn't work. There are many, many, many of them. Okay? So let me give you some examples. Take M6 to be one circle. This is a fancy notation for a circle. It's called an S1. Six times. Okay? That's a Calabi Yau manifold. You'd say, well, but that's boring. I mean, doesn't look very interesting. Let me tell you how this looks like and see if you can recognize it. You take one circle, and on top of every point of that circle, you put another circle. Right? So you go around. Then you put all these circles together. And guess what you got? A donut, yes. And that, no, that's not a donut. It's called a torus. OK. Now, how can you construct more complicated Calabi Yaus? Well, people started to realize that if you take, say, now an S2, okay? What is an S2? Well, an S2 is that you take an interval, and on each point on the interval, you put a circle, but you allow the circle to change in radius, okay? In such a way that when you get close to the endpoints of the interval, the circle, the radius goes to zero. Okay, and then it grows, reaches a maximum, and goes to zero again. Can anybody tell me what this is called? Well, doesn't look like what we usually call it, but it's a sphere. Topologically speaking, right? This is a sphere. Come on, I mean, just squeeze it a little bit and make it nice. It's a sphere, right? But not quite. It's what is called an S. So that's the fancy name. Okay. Now you take an S2, a sphere, and on top of each point you put a torus. Okay? And you allow the torus sometimes to become degenerate, meaning that you pinch one of the points here and so on. And then you put here something like that again, where this is pinched. And here you allow a genetic torus to be here, happily living here. Now you follow this path from here to here, and what you discover is that inside this geometry there is what? A sphere. Right? So clearly it's a sphere. Well, so mathematicians, it turns out that Kodaira, many, many years ago, he studied these spaces, and these are called K3. And the reason it's called K3 is because mathematicians were in a conference near where they could see the Himalayas and so on, and then they were like, oh, this object is so complicated that, understanding this thing would be harder. I mean, it would be harder than climbing K2, so let's call it K3. Something, I don't know if that's a story, but I already told you what K3 is, right? So, no, well, this is a special class of K3s. And a Calabi-Yau manifold that can be used for a complexification of a string theory is a K3 times a T2. You see, there are how many dimensions? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So that's so the reason I'm telling you this is that so Kodaira classified all these K3s and so on. And it turns out that the way these mysterious S2s can appear and they can be put together are in correlation to all the possible groups that you can put in here, quite mysteriously. I mean, there is a correlation between those groups there and so on. And you can then, with the discovery of D-brains, you can now put D-brains, take a 2-brain, right, which has 2 special directions and 1 time direction, and put it and grab this S2. So if the two-brain is grabbing the S2, how does it look like in our space-time? What do you think? So the D2-brain, or this 2-brain object, you take it, which is a membrane, right? But now you take it to grab an S2 in the internal space. So how does it look from our point of view? It's like these holes, you take a string, you wrap the string. If you don't wrap the string on the holes, from the moon, you still see the string, right, moving in the on the holes. If you wrap the string on the holes, and the string is just tight, it is very tight, close to the holes, and you go to the moon, how does the string look like? It would look like a particle from our point of view, right? You could not tell that there is an extension there. Now, if you take this membrane and you wrap it on these S2s, it looks like a particle. Now, the way these S2s are intersecting together and so on tells you how these particles interact with each other. So a string theory gave us a way of doing something that made my mother very happy. Because she always wanted me to become an engineer. So we now do geometric engineering. Which is, you tell me the field theory, you tell me the theory that you want in 4 dimensions, I'll tell you the geometry that produces it for you. Okay? I'll geometrically engineer the geometry that does it for you. So now it's time to conclude. And I'll conclude with the same thing here. Right? Now we see that a string theory has given us a landscape of possibilities where we have tons and tons of theories that are consistent theories of gravity with all other forces put in together. Okay? So what a string theory has done for us is to give us this landscape of possibilities. Okay. Just like the standard model doesn't explain precisely why nature chooses U1 cross SU2 cross SU3, right? But it's still remarkable that nature has chosen a very simple framework that relies on these symmetry groups to describe particle physics. So the same point is I want to make it here, which is that the string theory is now a framework where you have, for the first time, very, very explicitly, a framework where you can do quantum gravity in a consistent theory and has all the other, the possibility of adding all the other forces, either by brains, as I told you here. You can use brains to come out with the symmetry groups to describe the standard model particles, or using the geometry to grab brains on these fancy S2s that you now know to get all the standard model particles. Okay? And now the search is just like in the standard model case, people were trying to find with experiments which were the correct gauge groups to put in, right? Like U1 cross SU2 cross SU3. We are now searching for the right string theory that describes the world that we have. Okay? So let me stop here.
Questions, because we're a bit over, so let's say maybe three questions.
The end theory there, what was the end?
Nobody knows. It can be membrane theory, mysterious theory, whatever you want.
I was just going to ask, what are you working on right now, or what was the project you just completed?
Oh, okay. So I can tell you the title of the paper. The title was, "What is the simplest quantum field theory?" And basically, we tried to make the case that in four dimensions, the simplest possible theory that you can ever write down and you can ever study is actually a theory that has gravity together with some electrons, some scalars, in a very nice way that has an extra symmetry, which is called supersymmetry, at the maximal amount of them. And this theory was always kind of the underdog for many, many years. People never consider it very much. So we actually came out with a different point of view on how to look at this theory. And it seems to have the nicest properties you can hope for. And it would be the perfect testing ground for our understanding of how to use quantum field theory. Yes. That's a very interesting idea, but I mean, so you can describe the strings as classical objects vibrating and so on, but then there are very, very solid theorems that tells you that there is no way to describe quantum mechanics by using classical physics. So even if you describe the string by classical physics, it's still classical physics. So that's why we also quantize the string. So we also make the string, we also use quantum mechanics to quantize the string. And that's why the space-time dimension comes out, because if the string is just classical, it can do like particles moving any number of dimensions. The B equals 10 come from quantizing the string.
And how do you interpret quantum
mechanics? What kind of we use a standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, the one that you will learn in. Yes.
Today when you read about like string theory, in these books, like they always describe the 11-dimensional universe, right? So, like when you talk about this 10 dimensions, are you only talking about the spatial ones and the 5 dimensions?
No. These are 9 plus 1, and M theory lives in 11 dimensions. Very good question. Yes. So M theory is a 10 plus 1 dimensional theory, which in some cases it looks like a 9 plus 1 dimensional theory. So the corners are 9 plus 1.
Why do we need the other dimension?
It comes out. I mean, you don't really put it in. It just comes out to happen. It's once again a unification in one higher dimension. So this unification happens because we went one higher dimension. We already got, yes, we already got 6. What difference does it make to people?
So is there any sort of physical interpretation of any of the higher dimensions, or like the string theory?
Yes, from our point of view, yes, they are there. I mean, they are as physical as any other. A very important question is, like at the Big Bang, there are theories where all these dimensions are large, and then somehow some of them get compactified, right? The question is, what is the mechanism that compactifies six of them and leaves 4 extended dimensions? And there are theories where you can do the statistical mechanics, and you see that depending on some assumptions, you get that precisely 4 remain extended and 6 get compactified. But, I mean, that's a very complicated question. I mean, people would have to study much more. I mean, so you guys have lots to do. Yes. Maybe it's not. You already have.
What's the difference between M theory and super string theory?
Well, these are super string theories. And M theory is a theory in 10 plus 1 dimensions. Okay? So it also has lots of supersymmetries, but it actually doesn't contain strings. It only contains membranes and vibrates. And the strings here come out because these membranes wrap the holes that I told you and become, from the point of view of the 9 plus 1 dimensions, they become strings. Yes.
How do dualities actually connect to 5 strings?
How do what?
How do dualities actually connect to 5 strings?
Well, that's really a long story, but as I told you, what you do is that you classify all the objects and interactions of the objects in each of them, and then you try to see what happens to these deep brains and so on once you try to move away from them by making the interactions stronger and stronger. What happens is that when you take the objects in this guy and you make the interactions very, very strong, all of a sudden the interactions become as if they look as if they were weak interactions. I mean, weak is not the same sense as weak in the, well, maybe, but very, yes, the opposite one, okay, yes, weak interactions in the other theory. But now the objects get swapped. So the whole idea was to map these objects and their interactions. And there are certain quantities that can be reliably computed here and here, and they match perfectly. So you map out all these qualities and everything works very nicely.
In this case, brains with one space.
Yeah.
So do those brains also have memory, or are they just
everywhere? Yes, the deep brains, when they become one brain, they are, yes, that's right. They are standard objects. They have ends. Yes.
Okay. What are those? I can't imagine them. They can have every range of dimensions, but just depending on how much dimensions are
Well, there is another side. If you have an n-dimensional space and you have an n minus one brain that divides the space in two, right? Like you have three-dimensional space-time. If you have a two-brain line here, the two-brain separates the space into left and right, right? And that is called a domain wall. And physics can be different on one side or the other one. So those are things that people study.
Physics can be different philosophies.
The background, yes. I mean, not the fundamental laws, but the description of low energies can be different. Because there might be some fields that are turned on one side that have different values on the other side.
So I think we're a little bit over time, and we need to get over to the IGC. So let's thank Freddie.